is Telegram, is it good that people are, that people have Telegram still, or is it, are they vulnerable to things? Is it bad? Like when I say to people, yeah, the only thing that's really uncensored and left is Telegram. Is that a good thing, or is that like what do you make of that?
It's a bit of both.
Hello there, I'm Kevin Rothrock, the managing editor of Meduza's English Language Edition, and welcome back to another episode of The Russia Guy. We're now more than 3 weeks deep into Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, and one of the most common questions I've been hearing is, what information is still reaching Russians? Unless you're using a VPN to tunnel beneath the state's censorship, Instagram is blocked, Facebook is blocked, Twitter is blocked, YouTube is probably next, TikTok has suspended Russians' ability to share new content. The independent news media is in tatters. It looks like the main social networks left standing will be things like Odnoklassniki, Vkontakte, and Telegram. For a better understanding of what this means for Russia's information space, focusing particularly on Russians' increased reliance on Telegram, the Naked Pravda welcomes back two scholars for today's episode. But before we get to this week's guests, let me remind you that the federal censor is now blocking Meduza's website in Russia. Since the outbreak of this war, transferring money from Russia to Europe has been impossible, and Meduza lost 30,000 contributors in Russia. At this moment, we get no money at all from inside Russia, and that's why we're turning to you, our international audience, to take the place of our supporters in Russia who can no longer donate. Despite the Kremlin's best efforts, we still reach millions of readers inside Russia, and your recurring contributions now sustain our work and their access to independent information.
From the point of view of having access to alternative sources of information, however reliable they are, is, I think, by default, a good thing.
That's Dr. Tanya Lokut, an associate professor in digital media and society at the School of Communications at Dublin City University in Ireland. She spent more than a decade researching the Russian language corners of the internet, and she is the author of the book Beyond the Protest Square, Digital Media and Augmented Dissent, an in-depth study of protest and digital media in Ukraine and Russia.
However, because of Telegram's approach to content moderation, or lack thereof, what also happened is that, you know, it gives people access to information. It also gives people access to disinformation. So that's why I would say it's both good and bad.
But also, in addition, of course, we have some concerns about how Telegram portrays itself. So it has acquired this reputation of trying to fend for populations that are at risk.
That's Dr. Marielle Weiermars, an assistant professor in cybersecurity and politics at Maastricht University in the Netherlands. She's Tanya's co-author on an article published just a few weeks ago in Post-Soviet Affairs titled, Is Telegram a Harbinger of Freedom? Well, is it?
So, for example, how they communicated about themselves during the protests in Belarus, where they really took the side of the Belarusian people, saying that we are defending your rights, we'll make sure that we are available to you and do our best to help you during this time. But at the same time, of course, we know that some of the aspects of how they work actually put those kind of populations at risk. So need moderation. If you're not moderating enough, it also means that channels can become infiltrated. They can be manipulated. And we've seen traces of that before. So the public communication about themselves, so really positioning themselves as protectors of freedom, it's sort of obscures all of the other aspects. So it really only sheds light on part of what they do, and it obscures some other aspects that we as researchers are quite concerned about.
So what does that mean exactly? If the lack of moderation can leave certain groups vulnerable, how does that work exactly?
Well, I mean, for one thing, and I'm sure Marielle can give more examples, but, you know, so if we're talking about access to Telegram, I mean, yes, it's accessible to whatever Russian citizens, regardless of their political persuasion or how they think about the war in Ukraine. It's also accessible to Russian officials, Russian secret services. So
when you say accessible, do you just mean they can click on a channel and read it?
Yeah, they can access it to consume content. They can also access it to publish content. Mm-hmm. They can also access it to see what people are doing, which channels people are following. Because, you know, not everybody is adept enough, I think, to like be able to know how to hide their information on Telegram or hide their phone number. So, you know, it's a great place to find various kinds of information, including information that's hard to get if you're just watching Russian state media. But it's also a place where people can put themselves under great risk and then, you know, be persecuted, not just for posting stuff, but even for following certain channels, which we've seen happen in Belarus and which we're now also seeing happen in Russia. We've also seen, you know, where people are accosted by police on the street and they ask you to show them your phone and which channels you subscribe to. And like, that's obviously quite an easy way to find something that they can see as incriminating and therefore.
Mm-hmm. There's nothing Telegram could do about that, I assume, if like the cops are literally going to grab your phone and look at what you're subscribed to. I mean, that could be true of if you're reading anything, they could see that, I would think, or no?
I suppose, but I know that there are precedents of other apps that, you know, create this opportunity to like very quickly make the app invisible or hide it or whatnot. So like creating some mechanism where just by tapping a few things, you can, you know.
So you're saying that like Telegram presents itself as like the ultimate defense against the police state, but that they're, in terms of the way it's designed and the app itself doesn't actually do that.
Not good enough.
Not good enough.
Let's say it like this, not good enough. Yeah. So for example, also how it communicates about how it encrypts communication
right. Also
does not match really how secure it actually is. So that doesn't mean that it's worthless.
Mm-hmm.
It means that there's a gap in between what people perceive it to do, the level of protection that they perceive it to give,
right. And
what it actually does.
And this, you're referring to the fact that only the private conversations, which are kind of a pain to activate, those are the only end-to-end encrypted communications on Telegram.
Exactly.
And on WhatsApp, like they're all end-to-end encrypted, is that right? And Signal, and there are alternatives that they're encrypted by default, right?
Yes, exactly. Uh-huh. Yes.
And so I hear that. I've read that or whatever, and I've thought like, oh, okay, so Telegram doesn't do the thing with the basic stuff. How vulnerable does that mean that like it's fairly easy for police officers or for IT people working for police officers to grab communications off of Telegram then? Or what does that mean exactly in practice?
Well, I mean, in part, yes, because if you're talking to from person A talks to person B, and if this is an end-to-end encryption, then there are technical ways to intercept that. We've also seen other examples, you know, where like people have tried to hijack like phone numbers and, you know, basically like steal people's like login credentials and log into Telegram. And, you know, we've seen several of those things happen in Russia and elsewhere. And after that, it's like, oh, yeah, everybody should use, you know, two-factor authentication, et cetera. But like, you know, if the mobile operator is cooperating with the authorities, mm-hmm. what can we say? So I think I think for a lot of people, this perception of like, well, Telegram, you can use it for some things, but don't use it for things that you really want to keep secret, right? So like maybe you use it to whatever, follow some channels and consume news, but don't use it for actually secret conversations that you want to have with people where you really don't want anybody to know what you're talking about. There are better platforms for that. I think this is kind of also what we're seeing now in Ukraine, where a lot of local activists and volunteers and everybody are like, well, we probably should be getting off Telegram because it's just not a very secure place for us to be,
mm-hmm.
to have all these conversations. And there are better tools we can use to have the conversations that we really don't want anybody else to be reading.
This conversation we're having about Telegram, obviously it's not the first one that's been had about it in the sense of like, oh, there are problems with it. Why do you think then, I mean, why you've said that in Ukraine, they're waking up to this and they're pivoting to, I assume, Signal and other things, right? Probably those services. Why is that not happening in Russia? Like, to my knowledge, they're sticking with Telegram, and it's, if anything, they're more and more people are migrating to it. Like the people that are closing down their Instagrams and this and that, they're saying, find me on Telegram, go there. And is there just no alternative? Like, I know I suppose it's better than Vkontakte in terms of security and certainly in terms of user interface and so on. I mean, like, actually, I will say I've said this before, and people like yelled at me like, Kevin, what are you saying? Why are you praising Telegram's, you know, as a good app or whatever? And it's like, oh, but it's so nice. I got it on my desktop. I got it on my phone, my iPad. It looks great. It's just a great app. User interface, wonderful. And then people say, Kevin, you're an idiot. Like, you're surrendering. You're telling people to go a place somewhere bad. It's like you're pointing them into danger. Okay, fair enough. But like, it is a beautiful app. It looks fantastic. Is that why people are sticking with it? Do they just not care about the security like me?
I think it's quite similar to these big movements across platforms that we've seen before. So it's just about pragmatism. So where yeah. are the people that you want to be talking to? Mm-hmm. And it just happens to be that Telegram already has a really large mass audience. It's really ingrained in daily practices. It's ingrained even in business practices.
Right.
So that means that this is just something that everyone uses. But it might actually be smart to be moving to Telegram instead of moving things to WhatsApp, for example. Because as soon as Meta is branded an extremist organization, then you better not have it on your phone.
Right.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is, you know, it's just a, like, habit is a really powerful thing. Like, if people are used to using Telegram, and it's, moreover, right, it's still available, and like for most people, like when they hear, oh, well, Telegram is still available in Russia, they're like, okay, well, we can keep using it, you know, and nobody's really thinking, what does that mean in terms of, like, well, why is it still available? Like, despite all the history they have with the Russian state and, like, the FSB and whatnot, like, why are they still available, right? And so that's why we now have all these, like, rumors that crop up from time to time, and we don't know how much of it is true, that, you know, maybe they're collaborating in some sense with the state. Like, we really don't know, because nobody talks about it. The state likes to talk about it, but, you know, the state likes to talk in general, and they like to make assertions about who they are collaborating with or not collaborating with. You know, because, I mean, if you remember, like, at various times in the past 5 years, they also said that, oh, we reached an agreement with Facebook and with Twitter and with Google. And, you know, and now they're all blocked. So maybe apparently there was no agreement.
Right.
But it's the same with Telegram, right? Because there's no information and we can't really verify, because Durov isn't saying anything.
Yeah.
And the state is saying some things. Like, it's just really hard to know. But for most people, like, that maybe don't use Telegram for high stakes stuff, it doesn't really matter. It's available.
Yeah.
They're used to it. They know how to use it. All of their friends are on there. So of course they'll use Telegram.
Yes, of course. There was one thing that Durov has said, and that is that he proposed to limit both Russian and Ukrainian channels because of the spread of disinformation. And I think that this, for us at least, was quite a concerning thing. Because before, for example, in Belarus, the company really sided. So they sided with the Belarusian protesters.
Right.
But now they said, we will restrict access or restrict channels on both sides.
Yeah.
And this is really unheard of. So first of all, because they are under-moderating in general.
Yeah.
So this would mean that they suddenly become very active. And then to equate communication on both sides. And then, of course, is very risky. Because especially now, we know the dangers of having free flows of information. There is a danger of disinformation. But at the same time, this is also what is providing us access to the information coming from the region. So to close it off entirely means that we're also losing access to verified information. Mm-hmm. So this, of course, was then retracted.
Yeah, like 35 minutes later.
Criticism, they backtracked. They backtracked very fast. But at the same time, I think that is a statement that we need to take very seriously, because it really deviates from what we've seen before.
What do you make of the fact that he reversed on that, like literally after like 36 minutes? It was like, it seemed to be bizarre. Like, is it, do you have any sense of what was it, what the story is there? Because to me, it's like either that there's like the possibilities range from the whole thing was planned as a PR stunt to make them look, you know, so free and good versus like his IT team said they're going to walk off the job if they went through with it. Like, there's just like, anything's possible. Do you have any sense of like why that went down like that?
But I mean, that's the thing though, right? It's like, we really don't know. Cause I mean, you know, no matter how much, like there's, you know, there've been these attempts to like publish these like exposés and stuff about Telegram. And then like, there's really very little information about how they work, where they work. And I think that's, it's, it creates this like image of like this, whatever resistance, you know, V for Vendetta type stuff, or like, we're all, they're all working somewhere. Nobody knows where they are. They move around, but it also, it creates a sense that there's like, there's very little basis for us to trust Telegram because we don't really know what they're doing, where their allegiances lie. And if their allegiances lie with anyone, but, you know, Durov himself and whatever his business interests, you know, because obviously like, you know, he claims that his platform stands for certain things and has certain values, but also, you know, it's a platform, it's a business, it needs to make money, it needs to stay afloat. Right. And, you know, they've had several sort of cases where, like, you know, with their cryptocurrency and like with you know, those situations where like people just, maybe for the same reason, where like, you know, it just wasn't, they just weren't able to gain enough trust because people don't know enough about them and what they stand for and their values, you know. So at once they claim to be like for transparency and freedom of speech, but at the same time, they're very intransparent about even their own company or like, you know, who works there, where are these people, right, et cetera. So I think there's this tension. And for me, like, yeah. And also, you know, because as you say, like all we know, like literally all the stuff that relates to governance or anything, like it all comes from Durov personally, which is also really weird, right? Like they very rarely release any like company statements.
Right.
And everything comes from Durov, you know, so he made this statement about Ukraine, blocking Ukrainian and Russian channels. Then he retracted it. Then I think earlier he also posted something about claiming that he had like Ukrainian roots or whatever.
And that was, yeah,
one is, was, that why we should trust
that him? Was in English. He did that one in English, and then he did the policy suggestions in Russian. So it's also like, I talked to people that only saw the English one, aren't even aware he has a Russian channel.
Yep.
And so it is very much like, what is happening over there?
Exactly. And so it's like, yeah, Ukrainian roots. So does that mean like Ukrainians should trust you? That's not enough. I'm sorry.
So in terms, like a lot of people, I think a lot of people's response to that would be like, oh, so you're saying go trust like big tech in Silicon Valley instead because they have these transparency reports, but they're all beholden to the CIA, blah, blah, blah. Like, how do you respond to the, is that just a kind of like fringe conspiracy response and ultimately like, sorry, but Meta and Twitter are better than that because they are more transparent? Or is it all relativistic and no one should trust anyone and we should all just, there's like some little small startup project that maybe we can trust and everyone should go there until they become too big and untrustworthy as well? Like, is there any light of hope in this cyber world?
Now, we should indeed be very critical of all of them. And I think that it's a very positive development that now there's a lot more public awareness that this actually is something that is relevant and it touches everyone's lives, so that everyone should care about privacy, about the security of your communications, that even if you think that your conversations are not interesting, that actually they can put you in danger still. So the fact that we now have this public awareness, I think, is really important as it pushes companies to actually take this seriously and to take sufficient measures. So the level of transparency they receive, for example, from these Western platforms, the transparency reports that they publish, a few years ago, this was unimaginable that they would be doing this. And this really is a result of a lot more of this campaigning, pushing for respecting rights and also for more transparency. So of course, it doesn't apply now to all platforms. We see quite some deviations. Some have very extensive transparency reports, others publish none. So for example, TikTok now in Russia also is quite an interesting case because they self-blocked more or less. But at the same time, it appears that some of the things that they actually did were not communicated. So that half of their actions were communicated and then the other half was implemented, but not communicated. So the lack of transparency there about what they are actually doing and how it might impact the information that Russians are able to get, that really is a concern. So there are differences between the platforms, but indeed we should be critical of all of them.
And what did TikTok do that it didn't say publicly? I know that because they disabled like posting, right?
Yes. So what they announced was that they would disable posting within Russia. Mm-hmm. And this is also what they actually did. But now it appears there's a recent report that they also, at the same time, blocked all non-Russian channels.
For users inside Russia.
I see.
Which, of course, means that these users suddenly did not have access to all of those nice Ukrainian TikTok videos that we are talking about. Mm-hmm. This was not communicated.
Hmm.
Right?
Right. Okay, good. Or not good, but understood. Can I ask you a little bit more about the Belarusian case? Because I feel like that's something that people are not talking about. Because you two have written something, have you not?
Yeah, we have a recent paper that just was recently published as part of a special issue on Belarus that talks specifically about Telegram, not just as a platform that was used by both protesters and the Belarusian state, but as an actor in the Belarusian protests.
And so what, in terms of looking at that case, I know we've already discussed it a little bit, but You said that the main difference, at least in terms of what Telegram has signaled so far, is that they basically threatened to moderate both sides as opposed to side with the protesters. In terms of like the role that Telegram is playing in the Russian invasion of Ukraine and during the Belarusian protests, how similar is it? Because I know like on Telegram, when I click on Telegram, I've got a mix of these like channels with Z's, Latin Z's written in them. And then I've got a mix of channels with like dead Russian soldiers. And they're like, it's just like awful everywhere. I'm kind of like trying to like, I look at it through the corner of my eye, like, I don't want to see dead bodies. I don't want to see Z's. I'm just trying to get information.
But there's also lots of information. I mean, like on the Ukrainian side, which like all the, you know, my Telegram is full of, is like, you know, train schedules for evacuation, like all sorts of updates, volunteer stuff, organizing, like, that is all also there. Mm-hmm. And I think like, you know, so like in the case of Belarus, and obviously Marielle can add more, but like what we saw when we were looking at it during the protests in Belarus was that people were obviously using it to organize protests across the country, local chat groups, all of that, also educating each other on like what to do, how to make yourself safer, et cetera, et cetera. We also obviously saw Belarusian state using Telegram. So, you know, they also had channels. Their channels were not blocked.
Right.
But, you know, they were kind of there and they were putting out their own like press releases and reports about obviously disinformation about what was happening. But at the same time, Telegram released, like made several kind of very overt statements in support of the protesters. You know, like they added the sticker with the Belarusian flag. They replaced the like official flag with the real flag, you know, the white, red, and white, etc. So they kind of publicly took the side of the protesters and said that they would also try to keep the platform available for people, even though the state was trying to block Telegram alongside everything else.
What do you make of that? The Telegram rolled out some like new update recently with a bunch of Harry Potter cartoon characters, and one of the books had like the Ukrainian coat of arms on the cover.
Yeah, but that's very subtle.
They're in with
Well, it's kind of alongside this like doer of saying he has Ukrainian roots. I'm like, you know, like if you want to say something, just say it. Like, don't like use Dobby the Elf, you know, to stand in for Putin. Like, that's just lame.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But what if like he's concerned that going any more explicit would add them to the block list, and then would we be better off just because he made a public statement or something?
I think actually already last year they were very concerned. So this was during the Russian parliamentary elections, when there were these very high level confrontations between Western tech companies, so Apple and Google, and the Russian government over the removal of the smart voting app. And then Durov announced that they would also remove it from Telegram, so the smart voting bot, because Apple had threatened them to remove them from the App Store. So there are also these indirect ways in which,
right.
Of course, it's very complicated. And a lot of this happens where we do not see it, right? We do not have access to all this information.
But when they did that, Durov blamed, so he blamed Apple and Google. He's like, oh, they're the ones oppressing Telegram. We're forced to, you could still access this on our web app or whatever, right?
But that's because he has this constant, like, that's a constant refrain, you
right.
know, he keeps blaming Apple and Google as like being on the wrong side of history and like being the bad guys, whereas he is and his app is the hero.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's a nice story. I don't necessarily, like, I think Apple and Google certainly also did some things wrong when they were blocking the smart voting app.
Mm-hmm.
But like, you know, that just fits very neatly into his kind of ongoing narrative where he presents Telegram as like fighting for the right of the small person and all of that, and those companies are corporate greedy, et cetera. So he, like, it's part of a bigger story that mm-hmm. he's telling about Telegram.
But if we return to Belarus, then I think the situation is still quite different because in Belarus, actually, people were not using Telegram that much before the protests happened.
Mm.
So it was very much because of the circumstances. So because the internet was shut down, because Telegram was the only one pretty much that was still accessible with some level of reliability, that suddenly this mm-hmm. became the platform to use. So where you're able to access, for example, Nechta. So before that, people were using YouTube, they were using Viber, they were using all different kinds of services. So we were analyzing these chat groups and a lot of the discussions were about, can you still use this? Can you still use this platform? And then it turns out everything is no longer accessible. Also, a lot of VPN services did not work. So everyone ended up in Telegram and they had to use it because there was simply nothing else available. And of course, the current situation now, both in Russia and Ukraine, is very different. So you still have several services in parallel that are available, even though, of course, in Russia, the number of different services mm-hmm. is decreasing.
Right.
And people were using it before. That is also different.
Russia already theoretically blocked Telegram for like a year or so, a couple of years ago, but it was very ineffective. And I know that they've upgraded their censorship technology since then by adding deep packet inspection and just beefing up the whole system. Is there a possibility that Telegram would still be positioned to evade censorship better than, say, kind of like a big steamship organization like Facebook, which isn't capable of suddenly becoming like a ninja app or whatever and dodging censorship? Whereas Telegram's like, they present themselves as guerrilla warriors, so they're going to start doing all these funny circumvention things. Like that, when Telegram was blocked, it was like all their moves to evade censorship, it was like, are you guys just like in a basement, like having fun? Like, this doesn't seem like this went through, you know, tons of like levels of bureaucracy. Like, you guys are just kind of like winging it, aren't you?
Well, I mean, I think it's possible that they will have to work harder. I mean, certainly what we know, like from the tech experts, is that, you know, the whole sovereign internet and all of those filtering systems have gotten better.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we've seen this, obviously, with the amount of stuff that's been blocked and, you know, with their ability to throttle
yeah.
Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, and then to block it wholesale. I think, though, that even now with Facebook and Twitter being blocked, people are still in Russia are still finding ways to use them. Twitter is, I think, has created like a, you know, an onion version of their website that can be used with Tor. I think Facebook is probably doing the same. So everybody has like their own sort of things that they're doing to try and remain available to people. I mean, I think Telegram, as you say, it's probably a bit more nimble just due to the very design of their platform and because they've been working on these technologies for longer. So it might be easier for them to evade.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, you know, I mean, you know, if we come to the point where like, there is like literal disconnection or whatever from, you know, from Russia's side, they're just like, we're just going to disconnect. Like, then that spells trouble for everyone, including Telegram. I mean, unless they come up with some revolutionary way to remain accessible. But, you know, I think also like people are becoming more and more adept. Like, I've seen a story yesterday, I think in Kommersant where today, about the fact that like people are downloading various VPN services at record speed, like mm-hmm. millions and millions of downloads. So people are becoming more literate in that sense as well. So
yeah,
I don't necessarily know that like we will ever see like total isolation. I mean, unless they like cut the cables like physically. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
And also, if you think about a telegram in particular, then of course it has several functions, but also it is a messenger. Mm-hmm. So if you look at alternative messengers, then I think for them, the best one to keep and the one that also everyone is using, including within the government,
right,
is Telegram. So which one would you kick out? You would first kick out WhatsApp. So WhatsApp mm-hmm. has to go before Telegram can go. Or at least that's how I understand the logic.
And it likely will go because it's owned by Meta and Meta.
Well, I mean, for now, they've said that they're actually not going to ban WhatsApp because at first people thought they would.
If they make Meta an extremist organization, isn't every one of their products an extremist thing? I guess there's no rule of law. So
yeah, don't look for logic here. Okay. They did. So Instagram is off, Facebook is off, but WhatsApp is okay for now.
Right.
And I, you know, again, like I think like what Marielle is saying is correct. Like Telegram is kind of like, it's a dual use technology. So like it's used by opposition and protesters, but it's also used by the government. And it's also used by the secret services to spy on what Ukrainians are saying.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, on those channels where they're posting.
Yeah.
Reports on the number of soldiers who died, were captured, etc. So right. It remains a nice space for gathering information about what's going on, because as we know, Russia hasn't been as great as they thought they were about collecting information about what's happening in Ukraine. So maybe now they're like, we probably shouldn't cut off Telegram. We need to at least keep an eye on what's going on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, watch those Zelensky videos.
Right. Last question, what's your outlook for, I mean, you just said that you're not certain that it'll go all the way to total isolation and severing of the cables and whatnot, but like we are talking about WhatsApp maybe getting blocked, and it's not necessarily automatically going to be blocked when Meta is just declared extremist. If you click on a lot of the YouTube videos from the prominent YouTubers now, they sound like farewell videos. They're saying, you know, I don't know if this is the last one, find me on Telegram. If you had to speculate, what do you kind of think is possible or likely to happen in the next week or two in terms of Russian internet developments?
I think this is almost impossible to predict. Also because, to be honest, just the events of the past few weeks, everything has been developing so fast that it's almost impossible to comprehend what this will also mean. So if you also look at the Western companies, Western tech companies and services leaving the Russian market, that are really affecting the Russian internet sector in so many ways that we now see some cracks appearing, and we really do not know how this will develop. So this might also be something that they have to take into account. So is, for example, Yandex able to stay afloat? Because it might be that Yandex is collapsing at the moment. So they are selling off their core products. And their deputy CEO was just put under sanction by the EU. So there are massive shifts within the Russian internet sector as well, because of the various effects that the departure of Western firms and services, as well as the sanctions, are having.
Mm-hmm.
So this is also perhaps something that they have to take into account. So you want to have those kinds of services because they perform all kinds of societal functions. So you cannot just take them out because you don't like them. So if they still perform a function that you need,
mm-hmm.
then you might have to keep them. But at the same time, especially YouTube, I think is very much in danger, but it has been in danger for quite some time. I saw that Roskomnadzor a few days ago was again very annoyed that Spas, so the Russian Orthodox channel, was blocked again.
Mm-hmm.
So we keep on seeing these repeated calls where they say, please unblock, you're censoring us.
Yeah.
And this is, of course, something that is then very easily used as a pretext. But again, only at the moment where they feel that the balance within the choice means that they now have to block it. So, of course, we know this is what they also use for their own propaganda. It's a very essential platform. It's also a platform that many Russians use.
Mm-hmm.
So it might stay afloat a little bit longer, but we have to see.
Yeah. And I think, you know, actually the kind of the decision to, say, brand Facebook or Meta as extremist, I think it's very clever because, you know, it's one thing to just block Facebook and then like people try to use VPNs to keep accessing it. It's another one to say this is an extremist company, and therefore if you continue to use it, we can also punish you. Because that also means that people will probably feel like it's dangerous to still have an account or to.
It's like how they handled Navalny, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So it creates pressure on the company. It also creates pressure on the users, which is arguably much easier to exercise because, you know, especially if the users are inside the country.
Sure.
And I mean, for that reason, like, you know, VK is accessible, but also everybody understands that VK is beholden to the state.
Yeah.
Whereas Facebook wasn't, but now because it's branded as extremist, it's potentially just dangerous to use it. Mm-hmm. Even if you can't make any money or monetize from it. I mean, the same will probably most likely happen to YouTube if, you know, if it continues
right.
in the same vein.
Right.
Maybe to add one more thing. So now we're talking about services and whether they are available. But of course, you also have the dimension of censorship and self-censorship, which is now taking effect. So we see that the first people are indeed being fined or being prosecuted for what they have been saying online. And this then means that if you say no to war, or if you share any information about the war, that you can be prosecuted for this. So this is what we will be seeing more and more the coming weeks, that a service can be available, but if you're no longer able to really speak on that platform, mm-hmm. then that doesn't make a difference. And I think that this is something that we have not been discussing sufficiently in the past, or really focus on,
right.
but is this service available? But the problem is there any information on it? So there can be internet, but if there are no Russian journalists writing in Russian that are independent, it means that there's no information available.
You've been listening to the Naked Pravda, an English language podcast from Medusa. On today's show, you heard about Telegram and Russian internet censorship with special guests Dr. Tanya Lokut and Dr. Mariel Weiermars, two experts on Russian digital media and the global politics of internet freedom. The Naked Pravda is a podcast from Medusa. It's our only English language show, and I hope you recommend us to your friends and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're tuning in to help put this program in front of more people. And also, I'll say it again, I said at the top of the show, if you value Medusa's reporting, whether in English or Russian, please consider making a donation at support.medusa.io to help sustain our work. Recurring pledges help more, but we'll take whatever you can spare, of course. Thank you for listening and come back soon.